and welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's narration is part two of the history of the Ku Klux Klan. On Christmas Eve in 1865, in the law office of Judge Thomas Jones, in the little town of Pulaski in southern Tennessee, near the Alabama line, six young men, all Confederate veterans, concluded to organize a society of some kind. One suggested that they call it Kuklid, from the Greek word kuklos, meaning a circle. And some other person present said, call it Ku Klux. The word clan was then added to complete the alliteration. In order to arouse public curiosity and surround the organization with an atmosphere of mystery, various devices were resorted to. The oath bound the member to absolute secrecy in regard to everything pertaining to the order, and he was prohibited from disclosing the fact that he was a Ku Klux, or giving the name of any other member, or soliciting membership. Each member was required to appear at the meetings arrayed in a long robe with a white mask and very tall hat made of white pasteboard. The meetings were held at night in the cellar of a deserted brick house standing on a hill near the town. The officers were a Grand Cyclops, who presided at the meetings, a Grand Magi, who was a kind of vice president, a Grand Turk, or Marshal, a Grand Exchequer, who acted as treasurer, and two lictors, who were the outer and inner guards of the den. One of these lictors was stationed in front of the old ruin, and another between it and the town, both dressed in the hideous regalia of the order and bearing enormous spears. The only business transacted at the meetings was the initiation of new members, with the most fantastic of ceremonies, and the only purpose of the order was to mystify outsiders and to have fun. During the summer, the membership rapidly increased. The local papers contained many references to it, and the probable objects of the movement were being generally discussed. Young men from the country and neighbouring counties were initiated and organised dens in their own neighbourhoods, the same mystery and secrecy being maintained. The red lights and uproar of initiations, seen and heard at midnight from graveyards and haunted houses, were duly reported and repeated in the Negro quarter and among whites of the lower classes, with every exaggeration which ignorance and suppression could suggest. Acting on mysterious statements from gigantic shrouded figures who frequented lonely country roads at midnight, it began to be bruited abroad that the Ku Klux Klan were the spirits of dead Confederate soldiers. Travel along the roads on which the ghostly lictors stood sentinel was almost discontinued at night, and even the wisest and least imaginative persons began to wonder what it all meant. The most remarkable characteristics of the Negro race at the present day are their vivid imagination and universal superstition. During slavery and the years following the war, for obvious reasons, these characteristics were much more pronounced than now. The Ku Klux Klan readily appealed to these people as an incarnation of the powers of darkness, and it was soon noticed that in neighborhoods where dens were actively operating, no Negro could be induced to budge beyond his doorsill after dark. The rapidity with which the order spread during the winter of 1865 to 1866 was marvelous. And yet there was still no serious purpose behind the movement, and nothing to support it beyond the enjoyment of the initiations and the baffled curiosity of the mystified public. As time went by, however, and the members began to realize the amazing influence of the unknown over the minds and actions of men, and what a power was in their hands, and saw the unexampled rapidity with which the order crossed mountains and rivers and states, they themselves began to be imbued with the idea that some great mission awaited the movement. The discovery of such a mission was not difficult. The need of some drastic remedy for existing conditions was recognized by all, and the terror inspired by the Ku Klux Klan suggested that it might be utilized to protect property and suppress crime and disorder. At this time, there were probably several hundred dens in Middle and Western Tennessee, and a number in Mississippi and Alabama, but they had no general organization, no means of communication, no supreme authority, and in fact they had no need of such things. The idea of using the order as patrols or patrollers and regulators seemed to spontaneously spring up over the entire region dominated by the dens, without any consultation or chance for consultation among the scattered local leaders, and was promptly acted upon. As soon as this developed, it was deemed best to perfect a more regular organisation, and in the spring of 1867, the Grand Cyclops of the Pulaski Den sent out a request to all dens of which he had knowledge to send delegates to a convention to be held in Nashville. These delegates met secretly without attracting public attention and adopted a plan of organisation. The region in which the Klan operated was to be known as the Invisible Empire, divided into realms corresponding with states, and each realm was divided into dominions, corresponding with congressional districts, each dominion into provinces, corresponding with counties, and each province into dens. The supreme head of the order was the Grand Wizard. The ruler of a realm was a Grand Dragon, that of a dominion a Grand Titan, that of a province a Grand Giant, and that of a den a Grand Cyclops. A statement of the principles of the order, not for publication, contained the following words. We recognize our relation to the United States government, the supremacy of the Constitution, the constitutional laws thereof, and the union of the states thereunder. The special objects of the order were set out as follows. 1. To protect the weak, the innocent, and the defenseless from the indignities, wrongs, and outrages of the lawless, the violent, and the brutal. To relieve the injured and the oppressed, to secure the suffering and unfortunate, and especially the widows and orphans of Confederate soldiers. 2. To protect and defend the Constitution of the United States and all laws passed in conformity thereto, and to protect the states and people thereof from all invasion from any source whatever. 3. To aid and assist in the execution of all constitutional laws, and to protect the people from unlawful seizure and from trial, except by their peers, in conformity with the laws of the land. The secret Nashville Convention gave a still greater impetus to the movement, for the same unbearable conditions existed in almost every southern community, and the belief that nothing could be hoped for from national or local authorities was prevalent and well-founded. In order to more effectively carry out their plans and deceive the public as to their members, the Grand Dragon of the Realm of Tennessee issued an order for a general parade in each county seat on the night of July 4, 1867. A faint idea of the impression created can be gathered from the account of an eyewitness of what occurred in Pulaski. On the morning of that day, the citizens found the sidewalks thickly strewn with slips of paper bearing the printed words, "The Ku Klux Klan will parade the streets tonight." The announcement created great excitement. The people supposed that their curiosity, so long baffled, would now be gratified. They were confident that this parade would at least afford them the opportunity of learning who belonged to the Ku Klux Klan. Many came from the surrounding country. The members of the Klan in the county left their homes in the afternoon and travelled alone or in squads of two or three with their paraphernalia. Soon after nightfall, the streets were lined with an expectant and excited throng of people, their paraphernalia carefully concealed. If questioned, they answered that they were going to Pulaski to see the Ku Klux parade. After nightfall, they assembled at designated points near the four main roads leading into the town. Here they donned their robes and disguises and put covers of gaudy materials on their horses. A skyrocket sent up from a point in the town was the signal to mount and move. The different companies met and joined each other on the public square in perfect silence. The discipline appeared to be admirable. Not a word was spoken. Necessary orders were given by means of whistles. In single file, in deathlike stillness, with funeral slowness, they marched and countermarched throughout the town. While the column was headed north on one street, it was going south on another. By crossing over in opposite directions, the lines were kept up in almost unbroken continuity. The effect was to create the impression of vast numbers. This marching and countermarching was kept up for about 2 hours, and the Klan departed as noiselessly as they came. The public was more than ever mystified. The efforts of the most curious to find out who were the Ku Klux had failed. One gentleman from the country was confident that he could identify the riders by the horses, but as we have said, the horses were disguised as well as the riders. Determined not to be baffled during a halt of the column, he lifted the cover of a horse that was near him, and recognised his own steed and saddle on which he had ridden into town. The townspeople were on the alert to see who of the young men of the town would be Ku Klux. All of them, almost without exception, were marked mingling freely and conspicuously with the spectators. Perhaps the greatest illusion produced was in regards to the numbers taking part in the parade. Reputable citizens were confident that the number was not less than 3,000. Others, whose imaginations were more easily wrought upon, were quite certain that there were 10,000. The truth is that the number of Ku Klux in the parade did not exceed 400. It is safe to say that 90% of the work of the Klan involved no personal violence. In most instances, mere knowledge of the fact that the Ku Klux were organised in the community and patrolled it by night accomplished most that was desired. In case the nocturnal political meetings of the Negroes, organised by the scalawags and carpetbaggers, proved to be disorderly and offensive, sheeted horsemen would be found drawn up across every road leading from the meeting place. And though not a word was spoken, and no violence whatever offered, that meeting was usually adjourned. Sometimes the entire clan was divided into smaller bodies which rode all night, appearing in Negro quarters, distributed over a large section of country, and usually maintaining absolute silence and troubling no one. In case a Negro became insolent or dangerous, he was likely to be visited by a mounted spectre some 12 feet high, who asked for water, drank a bucketful with the remark that it was the first he had tasted since he was killed at the Battle of Shiloh, extended a skeleton hand, or what appeared to be his skull, to his unwilling host, and departed with the suggestion that he would call again in case the owner of the cabin did not improve his manners. No one who was not raised among Negroes can form the slightest conception of the potency of these methods. In dealing with objectionable characters among the whites, mysterious communications, sealed with skull and crossbones, were usually pinned upon their doors at night, warning them to mend their ways or leave the country. In many instances, all the officers of a county were notified that it was time for them to depart, and they did so with no unnecessary delay. There lives in the capital city of Texas an honourable member of our profession, who has held for many years one of the highest positions within the gift of the state, who organised every den in the state of Florida. I have his word for it that not one single act of personal violence was committed by any of these dens. Their most noteworthy achievement was the destruction of the entire shipment of guns sent from the north to arm the Negro militia of the state. Every telegraph operator, brakeman, engineer, and conductor on the road over which these arms entered the state was a Ku Klux. The shipment was watched at every point, and between Lake City and Madison, Florida, the entire 2 carloads of guns were thrown from the moving train by night by a select band of Ku Klux under the personal command of this gentleman, who had quietly boarded the train at the last stop. The Ku Klux left the train at the next station and destroyed the shipment before it was missed, and this notwithstanding the fact that 2 coaches filled with United States soldiers sent to guard the arms were attached to the same train. I am informed by one who participated in the movement that when the 1,500 stand of arms intended for the Negro militia of Arkansas left Memphis on the steamer Hesper, it was overtaken by a tug and the entire shipment broken and thrown into the river. The men who committed these acts may be condemned by some as lawless, but the destruction of tea in the Boston Harbor by comparison becomes rank piracy. But masked riders and mystery were not the only Ku Klux devices. Carpetbaggers and scalawags and their families were ostracized in all walks of life, in the church, in the school, in business, wherever men or women, or even children gathered together, no matter what the purpose or the place, the alien and the renegade, and all that belonged or pertained to them, were refused recognition and consigned to outer darkness and the companionship of Negroes. In addition to these methods, there were some of a much more drastic nature. The sheeted horsemen did not merely warn and intimidate, especially when the warnings were not heeded. In many instances, Negroes and carpetbaggers were whipped, and in rare instances, shot or hung. Notice to leave the country was frequently extended and rarely declined, and if declined, the results were likely to be serious. Hanging was promptly administered to the house burner and sometimes to the murderer. The defamer of women of good character was usually whipped and sometimes executed if the offence was repeated. Threats of violence and oppression of the weak and defenceless, if persisted in after due warning, met with drastic and sometimes cruel remedies. Mere corruption in public office was too universal for punishment, or even comment. But he who prostituted official power to oppress the individual, a crime prevalent from one end of the country to the other, especially in cases where it affected the widow and the orphan, was likely to be dealt with in no gentle way. In case a warning was not promptly observed, those who advocated and practiced social equality of the races and incited hostility of the blacks against the whites were given a single notice to depart in haste, and they rarely took time to reply. I have in my possession a letter recently received from one who in his young manhood was one of the advisers and leaders of the Klan in East Mississippi, and who subsequently for years served his state with distinction in the National Congress. I quote this language of his, worthy of all acceptation. "No victim of their displeasure never suffered without first a full and ample investigation of his case, ex parte, 'tis true, but all the facts were first found out and thoughtfully weighed for and against him, and the sentence carefully considered and made commensurate with the justice and necessity of the case. They made the punishment suit the crime." Where good men controlled, little real injustice was done. But in many instances, dens were dominated by the reckless and the cruel. These men committed crimes equal to, or worse than those the movement was intended to suppress, and ultimately brought the greatest reproach upon the order. The writer, after going over a very large amount of data, including a hurried perusal of some 13 volumes devoted by the committees of Congress to the subject, has become fully convinced that in a vast majority of cases, the victims of the Ku Klux Klan received just about what they were entitled to. On account of the secret character of the Klan, it was impossible for it to defend itself against many false accusations. Violence and crimes with which it had no connection were constantly charged to it, and it is well known that many arrests were made of lawless persons clothed in the Ku Klux disguise, who did have, and could have, had no connection whatsoever with the order. But the invisible empire, however its sway was exercised, was a real empire. Wisely and humanely, or roughly and cruelly, the work was done. The state governments under carpet-bag control made little headway with their freedmen and their militias against the silent representatives of the white man's will. Acts of Congress and proclamations of President Grant, backed by the army of the nation, were not sufficient to meet the desperate onset of men who, armed with crude weapons, were making what seemed to them the last stand for all they held sacred. Time is not allowed to review the history of the order in the different states. In some it lasted much longer than in others, because the conditions it was intended to remedy lasted longer. In September 1868, Governor Brownlow called the legislature of Tennessee together and had a bill passed comparable only to the Reconstruction Acts of Congress. By its terms, association or connection with the Klan was punishable by a fine of $500 and imprisonment in the penitentiary for not less than 5 years. Every inhabitant of the state was constituted an officer with power to arrest, without process, anyone known to be or suspected of being a Ku Klux. To feed, lodge, entertain, or conceal a Ku Klux subjected the offender to a fine of $500 and imprisonment for 5 years. And informers were offered one half of the fine. Notwithstanding these drastic provisions, the Ku Klux continued to actively operate in Tennessee for about 6 months thereafter. In the latter part of February 1869, the Grand Wizard, a citizen of Tennessee, issued a proclamation to his subjects, reciting the legislation against the Klan, stating that the order had now largely accomplished the purposes for which it had been organized, that the civil law now afforded adequate protection to life and property, that robbery and lawlessness were no longer going unrebuked, that the better elements of society were no longer in dread for the safety of their property, persons, and families, that the Grand Wizard had been invested with power to determine questions of paramount importance, and in the exercise of the power so conferred, he declared the clan dissolved and disbanded. It is believed that the Grand Wizard was no less a personage than Nathan Bedford Forrest. As the possessor of dauntless and sustained courage, resourcefulness, and a grim disregard of all consequences, no more ideal leader of such a movement ever appeared upon the American stage. This proclamation was addressed to all realms, dominions, provinces, and dens of the empire. But it had little effect beyond the borders of one state. Tennessee was the first southern state in which constitutional government was restored, and the scheme of reconstruction aborted. The writer is satisfied that as late as 1872 the Klan was a potent factor in other states. As a general rule, this grim protest against unbearable conditions disappeared with the worst of the conditions, and not sooner. In 1870, 71, and 72, the Ku Klux Klan consumed a large part of the attention of Congress, the President, and the Army of the United States. Investigating committees visited every section of the South. Many volumes of testimony were compiled. Hundreds of speeches were made. Martial law was declared in some instances, and proclamations issued in others. Still more drastic laws were passed, but in the face of all this, the movement relentlessly moved on to the accomplishment of its purposes. The Senate Investigating Committee and the Joint Committee of the Houses of Congress each presented majority and minority reports, the first to the effect that a conspiracy existed in the South of a political nature against law and the Negro, the second that misgovernment and criminal exploiting of the country by the Reconstruction leaders had provoked natural resistance. The great debates in Congress and the press of the country began to educate the people as to the awful conditions which had prevailed, and the revolution resorted to as a remedy. In 1872, Congress passed an act restoring the right to vote and to hold office to the real leaders and capable men of the South. The worst conditions had disappeared, the troops had been withdrawn, and what was known in the North as the Great Ku Klux Conspiracy was at an end. Just how much the acts of Congress and of the President had to do with the disappearance of the order, it is hard to say. But the scalawag and the carpetbagger disappeared about the same time, and it might be said that the purposes of the Klan had been substantially accomplished. The belief of most people in the North that the movement was organized and controlled by roughs and criminals, associated together for the commission of crime, and bent on re-enslaving the Negro and driving his northern protectors from the South, is not sustained by the facts. The men who engaged in this movement were largely of the very best. The leading editorial in The Nation of March 30, 1871, speaking of the ignorance and corruption of the carpetbag regime, says, "We might be told that phenomena like these may be witnessed in New York, which is true. But in New York no one is disenfranchised, and we may add that were decent people in New York hot-blooded, like the same class in South Carolina, and did they believe, as the South Carolinians do, that Ku Kluxing would work reform, they would be busy at it day and night, and many a hardened ruffian would be yelling for federal troops to save him from the consequences of his villainy. We say deliberately, too, that we believe a community which sits down, as we do, under some of the evils from which we have to suffer, and of which we hear of every day, is doubtless wiser than the South Carolinians, but it is very doubtful whether it is healthier in spirit. We seek neither to defend nor palliate Ku Kluxes, but we cannot allow the persons who sow the seeds from which Ku Kluxery naturally springs to throw the whole blame on the men who engage in it." Speaking of the typical Southern men of that day, Daniel H. Chamberlain, the Reconstruction ruler of South Carolina, said, "I consider him a distinct and really noble growth of our American soil. For if fortitude under good and under evil fortune, if endurance without complaint of what comes in the tide of human affairs, if a grim clinging to ideals once charming, if vigour and resiliency of character and spirit under defeat and poverty and distress, if a steady love of learning and letters when libraries were lost in flames and the wreckage of war, if self-restraint when the long-delayed relief at last came, if, I say, all these qualities are parts of real heroism, if these qualities can vivify and ennoble a man or a people, then our own South may lay claim to an honoured place among the differing types of our great common race." Such was the matured judgment of the Massachusetts governor of South Carolina during the Reconstruction period in regards to the class of men who organized and chiefly dominated the Ku Klux Klan, and there is nothing I would wish to add to it. Did the end aimed at and accomplished by the Ku Klux Klan justify the movement? The opinion of this writer is that the movement was fully justified, though he, of course, does not approve of crimes and excesses incidental to it. The abuses under which the American colonies of England revolted in 1776 were mere child's play compared to those borne by the South during the period of Reconstruction, and the success of the later movement as a justification of a resort to revolutionary methods was as pronounced as that of the former. Whatever may be your views, I leave the question with you, repeating the proposition with which I began, that amidst the conditions as they existed in the South from 1866 to 1872, scarcely a man in this audience would have been other than a Ku Klux or a Ku Klux sympathizer. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for more Albion narrations in the future.